Hi!
I'm Randy.
And I'm Claire.
And you're listening to Killer Vibes,
a true crime podcast.
Okay, so let me tell you about OJ and Nicole.
Yes, please. I'm very ready for this relationship drama. Lay it on me.
It's not a fun time.
Great. Oh my God, even more intrigue. I am about it. I love a good, like, dramatic love story interlaced with murder. It's just so good.
It is so good. And this is where we get our, like, second kind of thing to advocate for. So
okay.
If you're advocating for OJ's innocence, there's obviously that's what you're advocating for, mm-hmm. is innocence, which is fun. And then if you're advocating for his guilt, this has a lot to do with it.
Ooh, okay.
So unfortunately, OJ was a perpetrator of domestic violence.
What an asshole.
Yeah. So the police had responded to domestic disturbance calls 9 separate times.
Yo, that's a lot of times.
And those are the times that, like, calls were placed.
Yeah.
And he pleaded no contest to spousal abuse in 1989. And there's a really, really awful, upsetting, saddening 911 phone call that got, not leaked, but when this was happening and he was a suspect before he was charged, some smart journalists went and did a records request for 911 phone calls regarding the address of Nicole's house. And the people doing the records request didn't say no because they
weren't. Right, because they didn't know that they had to say no. yeah.
So it's kind of funny. Some sneaky journalism work.
Get in there early, you know?
Yeah. So they actually got some 911 phone calls when this was all kind of like coming to fruition and released them. And there's one that makes me so upset and just, like, terrified for Nicole, where she says, like, the 911 operator says something along the lines of, like, just stay on the phone with me. She says something, like, prompting Nicole. And then Nicole says, I don't want to do that. He's going to beat the shit out of me.
Ooh.
The sound of her voice is almost like she's, it's not like a terror thing. He's going to beat the shit out of me again.
It's almost like it's a daily occurrence. Like, right. It's a commonality more than something that's happening, like, one-off or every month or something like that.
Yeah, like, when you listen to the phone call, it's almost like she's very experienced in this. And the 911 operator tells her to do something. She's like, no. Like, she's comfortable, like, in the setting, which you should not be comfortable in.
No.
So I just want to make this clear, like, very clear before we move forward. I think OJ is an abusive, narcissistic asshole.
Yep.
Who is probably capable of murdering Nicole. But do I believe wholeheartedly, without a doubt, that he is a murderer? Like, that's a different question.
Sure.
And so I don't want to have any sort of, I love OJ, or like, OJ is the best, like, because that's not the case at all.
No.
I've heard the 911 phone call. I know that he is an awful human being.
Yeah.
Doesn't make you a murderer. So that's what we're examining here today. Not necessarily, do we love OJ or do we hate OJ? The question is OJ innocent or is OJ guilty? So
exactly.
Just, you know,
just clear the air.
Recognize the differences in those two things. So
Gotcha.
So now I'm going to tell you about my favorite trial in the history of trials so that we can all have, you know, our opinions and talk about them later. So before I tell you about what happened in the trial, let's talk about our key players. So let's go prosecution side first, because they go first.
Okay.
So Marcia Clark is the lead prosecution attorney. She was a deputy district attorney with the Los Angeles DA's office.
Mm-hmm.
And she began her career as a prosecutor in 1981. She was actually a public defender before, which is a woman after my own heart.
Yes.
And I think that she just kind of, which this happens to a lot of public defenders, is you just get, like, bummed out about society.
Sure.
And you're like, I think I'd rather go catch the bad guys.
Yeah.
That happens sometimes. And that's fair. So before OJ, she famously prosecuted the murder of actress Rebecca Schaefer successfully. And she was just used to prosecuting high profile murder cases, which is why she obviously took the lead on this case. She was a experienced prosecutor. She'd kind of done the limelight thing before, obviously not to this extent.
No.
But she was just like the woman for the job.
Yeah, she fit the profile.
Totally. So Chris Darden is her co-counsel, and he was also a very experienced prosecutor. But at the time that he was asked to join the team, he was actually working with the Special Investigation Division, which investigates crimes committed by law enforcement. So these are divisions in district attorney's offices who will look at crimes committed by, like, the people on their side, essentially. Sure. So, like, law enforcement or public officials, people that they're working with usually. And even though they shouldn't be partners, even though those should be separate entities, they're not. No. So you kind of have to have that check in place. So really big departments like the LA DA's office will have this thing going on. So he was doing that. And this will be important later, but just keep that in mind. He investigated law enforcement.
So, fabulous.
I can't wait to tell you that part later. Okay, sorry. So he was first asked to join the OJ team to prosecute AC, the friend who was driving the Bronco, for aiding and abetting a fugitive. But then they decided to drop that case because it was kind of dumb.
Yeah, because could he even be, I mean, like, what are the parameters of becoming a fugitive?
You could label him a fugitive because he knew there was, first of all, there's a warrant for his arrest.
He made
this agreement to arrive at the LAPD's office at a specific time, and then he didn't, and then he drove away.
Okay.
So, like, yeah, but it was just a dumb thing because of the circumstances of this. Like,
and plus, like, the suicide note and all of these threats to his life.
Like, what's your friend going to do? Be like, no, I don't want to aid and abet you. Like,
it's like, oh, sorry. I would aid and abet you.
I would aid and abet you, too.
Oh, my God. Thanks.
Oh, love you.
Okay. Love you, too. Sorry. I realized I said okay after you said that to
like,
me.
Okay.
It's like, okay.
You can love me back if you want to.
Okay. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Let's try it again. Love you.
Oh, love you, too.
Okay. There we go. So once they decide to drop the case against AC, they're like, hey, Chris, come on over here.
Head on
Let's
over.
Prosecute OJ together.
Let's do this as a team.
Yes. So there is a lot of speculation that Chris Darden was actually asked to join the team because he was black and because it would look good to have a black man prosecuting OJ to kind of like make it a foolproof thing. Mm. I don't know. But really fun fact about Chris Darden that I just learned, I put it on Instagram because on our Instagram, on the Killer Vibes one, because I was so excited to learn about it. So he is actually a defense attorney now and defending Eric Holder, the man accused of killing Nipsey Hussle.
Interesting.
So
he's not sticking to the status quo.
You know what? I love a rebel.
Same. They always get stuff done. They always make a splash.
I put on the Instagram, I was like, is it just me? Or does he keep picking the wrong side? And like, no one said anything. And I was hoping that people would
know who, like, that is.
Well, like, they definitely know who he is. But I was like hoping more people would be like, yes, he is. And be like, share in the excitement with me. But no one did.
But they didn't.
Participate on our Instagram.
Participate.
So we have a third co-counsel, which you might not have known.
I did not know that.
People only think of Marcia Clark and Chris Darden.
True.
Let me tell you why. So his name is William Hodgman, and he was another DDA on the case. And he was like up there with Marcia, like they're going to work it together. And then Chris got added and they like did all the preparation. He was the second chair, which just means he's like, she was the lead and he was like second.
Right.
So they did all of the preparation, the jury selection, which was like a process in this case.
Oh my God. I can only,
we'll talk about juries later.
Story.
We'll
okay.
Talk.
I'm so excited.
I have a fun fact about jury. This jury that I don't think you know.
Okay.
Do you know a fun fact about this jury?
I don't know a fun fact
about
this jury.
Oh my gosh. You're going to be so excited.
Okay. I know they went to a baseball game.
We'll talk about sequestering later. So, yeah. So, jury selection, like, all the pre-trial stuff, which is, like, a lot, and opening statements.
Yep.
But then, during a prosecution strategy meeting, like, after the opening statements, he was complaining of chest pains, and he was hospitalized.
Stress.
And then, he, like, couldn't come back.
Oh, no.
So he prepared the entire OJ case and didn't get to do it.
No.
I know.
That's so irritating.
I know. So, no, he did not have a heart attack in the middle of the courtroom.
I was going to just say.
As depicted in the FX series, that didn't happen.
But what a dramatic thing that would have been.
I know. Because in the series, there's a part where, so you have to, like, hand over your witness list to the other side. And the defense had, in the show, the defense forgot to do it. And they were going to bring up these witnesses in the opening statement, but then the other side wouldn't have had an opportunity to also bring them up and say, this is what they're going to tell you, but this is why they're wrong in their opening statement, because they weren't on the jury or the witness list. And then the defense was like, we're just going to do it anyways. And so they start the opening statement in the show. And to clarify, this is in the show. It's not real.
No.
And they're like, they say, like, one witness's name, and he's, like, so upset and objecting, and the judge is like, counsel, is this true? And they're, like, all, like, having their whole thing, and then he just falls to the ground and has a heart attack. And then they, like, wheel him out of the courtroom. That did not happen, but I wish it did.
Like, it just, I don't know. Sometimes films depict events in real life. And they're just so much better than the actual events.
When you said that guy was, like, peeking over a hedge, like,
yes.
I wish that was how that happened.
Oh, my gosh. Because that's the one thing that I, like, distinctly remember about that first episode. Because I was in a communications law class, and we were talking about privacy. And one of the big issues is, like, reporters peeking over really tall hedges and getting pictures
invasion,
of people.
Yeah,
so it's...
Or intrusion.
Yeah. It's,
I always get those words.
It's just like you have an expectation of privacy and then it's invaded or whatever. So that's what I remember. But these things are not real. And we're clarifying. Or Randy's clarifying.
Well, the hedge thing could have been real. I don't actually know exactly how that picture came to be. So it could have been real.
Who knows?
But I don't think that that's how that happened.
Probably.
If I had to guess. But
it was probably through, like, a grate or something like that, like a fence.
Probably. But this is the one thing that I really wish was true, because I just love the idea of someone being so worked up about justice that they have a heart attack, which actually probably, I mean,
That would happen to you.
I almost did sitting in here. I'm, like, sweating right now. And this
She's
is, like,
so excited.
A resolved case.
Oh, my God. But you totally would when you're, like, 60 and you're still presenting cases because that's
60,
all you
want
to do. And you just have a heart attack.
I honestly would be fine dying that way.
I wouldn't be surprised.
But William Hodgman did kind of do that, just on, like, a less dramatic scale. He had chest pains because he was so worked up about OJ.
Yes.
I love it.
It's true dedication.
It's so wonderful. It's so sad that he didn't get to prosecute the case that he worked
really disappointing.
Like, forever on.
Yeah.
And for countless hours and
I can only
so
imagine.
Many headaches, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That's a bummer. But I still think that's cool. Okay.
Yes.
So now let me tell you about the defense. I don't know why I said it like that.
Defense.
The defense attorneys.
Yeah.
Also known as the Dream Team.
Woo woo.
So we've got Robert Shapiro, which I already told you about. So he was leading the Dream Team until OJ promoted Johnny Cochran to lead attorney. So Shapiro was still a huge contributor to the Dream Team. I don't want to make it sound like he wasn't, but he didn't have much litigation experience because he was like a plea bargaining person and he would like dismiss cases and just negotiate them outside of court. So he didn't have to do a lot of standing in front of a jury. And because of that, and because he kept saying some kind of stupid stuff, OJ was like, I'd rather have Johnny be the lead attorney.
Yeah, he's probably the better choice.
Yes. So Johnny Cochran has extensive trial experience, and his focus at the time was litigating high-profile police brutality cases. So, like, perfect for this situation.
Yeah, honestly.
A lot of OJ's defense relies on police misconduct and police racism. And he was also, this is interesting, Johnny, was the first black ADA in LA.
Awesome.
But then he was like, never mind, I'll go work as a defense attorney because, like I was saying earlier with the public defender's office, like pushing you into wanting to be a prosecutor, mm-hmm. the same thing can happen the other way around. Like the prosecution office can be like, oh, no, I'll go be a defense attorney.
Yeah.
And he probably knew that going in, but he saw a lot of value in being a good prosecutor, which right. I love that.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, I'll just be a just prosecutor and then we won't have as many issues for defense attorneys to have to defend, mm-hmm. which is a really good, you know,
that's the sort of mentality you should have.
Some good logic right there.
But it's okay.
But I don't know if he got really like that. Jaded at the DA's office.
Sure.
Or like maybe his plan to do that just didn't really work because you have to do all this stuff and it kind of contradicts justice sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes.
But he was the assistant district attorney in LA, which is pretty cool.
That is really neat.
Which is like the second in command. So mm-hmm. that's awesome. And then he started his private defense attorney firm, his private defense firm. And that's when he joined OJ's case, he had a private firm.
Awesome.
I don't know. That was very repetitive.
No, but that's such a cool story though, to have this like fluctuation in his law career. That's really interesting.
I love Johnny Cochran. The whole reason he wanted to become an attorney is because he watched Thurgood Marshall argue the Brown v. Board case. And he was like,
oh my God, could you imagine that?
Yes. Oh, and he was like, I want to make a difference that way. Like, yes. That's what I want to do.
Yes.
And that's why I want to become a lawyer, too.
Yeah.
So, well, not specifically like that one guy in that one case, but watching people make a huge difference by using the law and using their knowledge as power is so cool. And I want to do it, too.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to.
So she's going to.
Okay. So our next defense attorney is Effley Bailey. So this is probably going to be fun to you because you know Sam Shepard.
Yes, I do.
Okay, so he was convicted of, like, murdering his wife, and he's a doctor. Mm-hmm. And then he was famously exonerated because Effley Bailey, this guy, his exoneration attorney, argued that his case was already convicted in the media. There's no way he got a fair trial. And mm-hmm. a lot of our discussion about prejudicial publicity comes from the Sam Shepard case, actually. And Effley Bailey, who actually successfully argued that he didn't get a fair shake because of the media, which is a hard argument to make because judges will just be like, we're not going to overturn a conviction mm-hmm. because of the media. Like, that doesn't happen very much. So
right.
Effley Bailey is like,
killing it.
Very persuasive. Yeah.
Yes, I love it.
So he joins the team.
Ah, so many good players
here. Oh my God, you don't even know yet.
Okay.
There's one more that you're going to be so excited about. So then we have Robert Kardashian. So Robert was OJ's best friend, like I said earlier, and he was a lawyer, but not a criminal lawyer, and he had actually let his license expire at this time. Like, he wasn't actively being a lawyer.
Yeah.
I was going to say lawyering. He wasn't actively lawyering.
He wasn't actively, you know, lawyering.
That's probably a word.
I don't know.
I'm going to say it is because it's fun to say. He wasn't actively lawyering when OJ was charged. But OJ was like, you have to join the team. Like, you're my best friend and mm-hmm. you're a lawyer and I trust you. So, like, please. So he did. He was kind of like a behind the scenes guy more. Like, he didn't do a lot of the examinations or he didn't do the opening or closing, but he was like there the whole time supporting OJ. And he obviously did the preparation stuff and like the strategies and just helped with all of that stuff.
Absolutely. And he already had a level of notoriety to his
Not
name.
At all.
Not at all. This is kind of what cemented the Kardashian name.
People had no clue who he was.
Well, they know who he is now, and they definitely know his children.
Yeah. It's actually funny because he read the suicide note in a press conference, and people were like, who are you?
Like, I'm sorry.
He's like, I'm Robert Kardashian.
Hello.
I'm a lawyer and businessman.
You'll all love Kim. She's my daughter.
Okay. So some people think that Robert Kardashian joined the Dream Team so that he wouldn't have to testify against OJ because he would have attorney-client privilege, and you can't commit perjury with attorney-client privilege. Like, they can literally be like, I did it, and
And you can't, tell anybody.
You can't be called to testify.
No.
So people think he did that for that reason. But I just think he was helping his friend. And I want that to be the story. So that's what I'm telling myself.
Cool.
So, okay. My favorite.
Okay.
Barry Scheck, I think that's how you say his name, was also on the defense team. He is not only my favorite member of the Dream Team, but he's one of my favorite people ever because he co-founded the Innocence Project.
And we all know Randy loves the Innocence Project.
You might be tired of me saying how much I love it and how
it's a good program.
I want them to hire me. If you're listening, hire me.
Hire Randy.
Two dream jobs, ACLU, Innocence Project. I've
absolutely
on this podcast asked to be hired by them.
By both of them now.
They're not listening.
They someone might be listening.
Someone go put this in their ear.
Yes. Tell them that Randy is ready to go right now.
Right now.
No,
well,
she's
I might
not.
Be there. I might be doing that stuff in as little as 6 months.
I know. It's so exciting.
I actually chose my law school partly because the Innocence Project for the state is in the basement of the law school. And they were like, you can come down here and volunteer.
Yes,
like,
it's perfect.
I'm doing that.
Absolutely.
So he founded that in 1992 with another guy. But he is actually the one who tears apart the DNA evidence on cross-examination. So we'll get to that later. But he is just my favorite.
He's a swell guy. He's got his head screwed on straight.
He sure does.
He's a good lawyer.
What? That was so many compliments, Claire.
I was trying to figure out which one would be good.
So you said them all?
The ones that came into my head.
They're all true. And you know what? He kind of deserves multiple, so.
So there you go.
Okay. So there were other lawyers on both. I cannot talk because I'm so excited.
Lawyers.
Can you tell how
you had an
words...
Oklahoma accent for 2 seconds.
I do that when I'm not thinking about not having one. Like in times right now where I get really excited and I just am not really paying attention to it.
The lawyers down there.
It'll come out. It's really embarrassing. Okay, so there were other lawyers.
Good. There were other lawyers.
Not lawyers.
Lawyers.
Some
well,
lawyers.
Well, you can say it like that, but Randy doesn't. You don't. That's
well,
not really...
okay. I've had a Southern accent and it went away after like a year of living not in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like people respect me more. Because I also have a high-pitched voice. So, like, that combined with a Southern accent, people are just like, you're stupid.
Yeah.
And so I kind of don't want to have it, which is sad because
it's part of you.
My voice.
Yes. But I get it. I understand.
I just try not to have one, and it's fine.
Well, I'll warn you when you say things.
Thank you.
In a cadence. I'll be like, your Oklahoma's coming
I
out.
I love a Southern accent. I love them, but people don't. I feel like other people don't. So, okay. The other lawyers on both sides that were, like, working on the, they were, like, on the team, but they weren't doing the examinations and the closings and the openings. Mm-hmm. So you don't really need to know about them. But just know that there were other really hardworking lawyers on both sides that I didn't mention.
Yeah. They're kind of in the background.
Yeah. Okay, so now let me tell you about our judge, Lance Ito. He presides over felony criminal cases for the LA Superior Court, and you're going to love these two facts so much.
Okay.
First fact, he was married to Margaret York, who was the first female chief of police in LA.
Yes.
Better fact, number two.
Okay, I don't know if you could top that, but all right.
They met at a homicide scene.
Really?
That's their meet cute, is a murder scene.
I want that to be my meet cute.
Me too. Oh my gosh.
You already had yours. That is not fair.
I could have another, like a friendship one, though.
That's true. What was our friendship one?
I hired you as a reporter.
Yeah.
It was an interview.
Oh, in the BSB.
Yeah.
That's good. That's the behavioral sciences building.
Yeah.
For those of you not in the know.
Because we weren't friends. We were friends, but we were like coworkers first.
You were my boss for a minute.
But you were wonderful. And then.
Thank you.
And then when I left, like a couple months later, she took my job because she like learned so quickly and is an amazing journalist.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Love you.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Automatic response. Not that, well, never mind.
What?
I was going to say, not that many people have told me that they love me, but if they do,
so
I
just
usually
say,
just
okay.
Say okay.
Yeah. Do you watch That 70s Show?
Uh-huh.
I love that episode when Donna tells it Eric that she loves him and he says, I love cake.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That was so funny. Okay. So anyways. Okay. So let me tell you the prosecution's case. Their strategy was hard evidence and an airtight story.
Love it. Good strategy.
Good strategy. So their first argument, the timeline makes sense. If the murder happened when the neighbor, oh, I forgot to tell you about the neighbor. Okay. Oh my God.
The neighbor.
Not the neighbor, but the neighbor's dog.
Oh my God. I know about the neighbor's dog.
I'm sorry. I forgot to tell you that.
I was going to ask you about that, but I was like, I feel like I shouldn't ask her because I feel like it's going to come up later and she's going to tie it in a more effective way than telling everyone
right
now.
I just skipped over it.
Yeah. Because you were like, the body, they were murdered at 12:30. The police arrived at 5 a.m. And I was like, wait, I'm sorry.
Well, no. The police arrived at 12:10 when it was called in.
Okay.
But the detectives didn't get there till 5.
The detectives arrived.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes more sense.
Yes.
I was like, the way I heard it was like the police showed up at 5 o'clock. And I was like, I feel like that's wrong.
Well, if we knew exactly what time they got murdered, we would probably know who did it.
Probably. You're totally right about that.
So, okay, let me tell you about this
dog.
So, the neighbor heard a dog barking around the time that the murder would have been, like, happening at, like, 10-something.
Okay.
And then the dog, their dog, the one who was probably barking.
At the murder. Yeah.
At the murder. Was barking on the street, and then a passerby was like, what's wrong, little buddy? And he was like...
Sorry.
Come over here and like barking and like running towards the murdered bodies.
Yes.
So that
someone would pay attention.
So that they would find the murdered bodies.
Dogs are too pure. Dogs are too pure for this world.
I have to say. I don't have anything to add. That's accurate. Okay.
There you go.
So back to our timeline thing, or the prosecution's timeline. So they...
Sorry.
My foot doesn't need to be there.
I saw your foot and I was like, what the hell is
I'm getting really comfy in here. What is this?
I don't even know. I love it. I'm embracing it.
Thank you. Okay. So they were saying that if the murder happened when the dog was barking at like 10:15, then that would have given OJ plenty of time to go eat dinner at McDonald's, arrive home, murder them, come back and clean up and meet the limo driver as if nothing had happened.
Right.
Because that's like an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So makes sense. And important to note that his house, the Rockingham Estate, that's what it's called, OJ's house, was only 6 minutes away from Nicole's townhome in Brentwood.
So quick walk.
Mm-hmm. Or drive in the
Either
Bronco.
Way. Yeah.
Because someone saw the Bronco, or the limo driver says that he didn't see the Bronco there when he pulled in, but that it was there when he left.
Interesting.
But then other witnesses contradict that. So we don't, it's a weird contested point.
Yeah.
So their second, you know, the main piece of their, I'm saying like just pieces of their prosecution.
Sure.
Case. There's obviously
more
like
than that,
months of a trial happening. So I'm just highlighting some stuff for you. So they really highlight the motive. So Nicole and OJ had broken up. And when the murder occurred, several people have this theory that Ron and Nicole were growing closer, whether that was as friends or as in like a relationship kind of thing.
Right.
At first glance, it seems like Ron was just bringing her glasses home. Nice waiter at this restaurant, but a lot more could be read into it.
Sure.
Sorry. Oh, we both had to cough.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. I have like a tickle in my throat.
So the prosecution says it doesn't really matter if Ron and Nicole were actually together. What matters is that OJ thought they were and got really jealous. And we already
Absolutely.
Know that he is capable of God knows what of doing to Nicole.
Yeah.
Because we only hear the 911 phone call part of it. We don't actually know, but we can imagine it's worse
Pretty
than
horrific.
The 911 phone call.
Yeah.
So They were like, all the motive is there.
Yeah.
All he needed to know was that Ron was going to her house.
Honestly. Yeah. And that's effective.
And that would have been easy to find out because he went to the Mezzaluna a lot. What if someone was like, hey, Ron's going to bring Nicole's mom's glasses to her house. What's that about?
Yeah.
And then he was like, oh, really? Well, I'll go murder them. Mm-hmm. Or maybe he was just like stopping
or
by.
Or confront them or something.
Yeah. Or maybe he just saw Ron arrive at the house or something.
Because he's so close by.
Or maybe he was just going to murder Nicole and Ron was just there.
Yeah. He could have, poor Ron. I really feel bad for Ron.
I know.
This is making me feel bad for him.
I know. Me too.
I mean, he was murdered, so I already felt bad for him, but like now I feel even more bad.
Yeah. So, okay, so we have timeline makes sense. Motive is totally there.
Totally.
Their last like major piece of their case is the evidence. So let's talk about it.
Do you want to talk about it?
Oh. I was like, yeah, I do. Okay, sorry. She was motioning to the time.
Yes.
Okay. We'll do it in part three.
Okay.
Thanks for listening.